I hope everybody can hear me. Welcome to this webinar about all these new rules and regulations in healthcare. I've asked Larry Grutson here, who's an attorney practicing exclusively in the field of employee benefits. He has over 26 years experience in the employee benefit law, extensive practice advising on all aspects of employee benefits. He has a book or a couple of books that are written about this, just a list of credentials and certificates and on boards and so forth to work in this field. And he's here today to try and bring us up to some type of speed as far as the things we'll need to do in this new world. So Larry, you're there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Okay.
Welcome, everybody. What I'm going to be trying to do today is explain to you what you need to do in regard to healthcare reform. And the employer mandate is coming in 2014. Now, as an introduction to this, please remember that, and I'll be talking about this, any employer, 50 or more employees, are subject to the employer mandate. And there's going to be mandated coverage you have to provide to the employers or you're going to be penalized. Well, one thing to look at is the fact that as I go through the presentation, if you have any questions, if you look at the bar, the control panel is to your right. If you look down, there's a question tab. If you have any questions during the presentation, please type in your questions, and we'll take time at the end of this at the seminar to answer any questions you may have. This presentation is going to be recorded. Mark will have a copy of this presentation, so if you have any questions or if you want to listen to it again, just contact Mark, and he'll have a copy of it. This area is extremely complicated, very convoluted. And one of the biggest questions I get is, well, is this going to be up and running in 2014? Is the government going to delay this? And all indications are that we've been hearing over the last probably month or so is the key to all this, starting in 2014, is going to be the exchanges. Now, the best way to understand what the exchanges are is going to be similar to going to Expedia and picking airplane tickets. Where there's going to be an array of plans that an individual small employer can go on and purchase either individual group health insurance. There's going to be exchanges in each state. But the problem is that currently only about 17 states have actually started in exchanges, and seven more have just gotten approval. All the other states, the HHS has to come in and establish an exchange for that state. So it's going to be a daunting task before HHS to do that, but they said they're going to have it up and running. What I'm concerned about is because the first open enrollment for those exchanges are going to be October 2013. So they're going to have something up in October 2013. We don't know what it's going to look like yet. We should get some inclinations probably in the next month or two how they're doing, but all indications are jobs are on the line to get this all done. So they're going to throw up something to be ready by October 2013. So in over 30 states, HHS will have to establish an exchange for those states, and most of those states are in the West and in the South. So let's look at this and see what's going to be happening in 2014. So beginning in 2014, certain large employers may be subject to a penalty tax if they don't offer any coverage at all, or they offer coverage that is not affordable or minimal essential coverage. Affordable means that at no time will the employees pay more than 9.5% of their household income for any premiums. And secondly, any employer plan must cover at least 60% of any expenses under the plan. And the penalty tax is due if at least employees go on the exchange, and that's why these exchanges are extremely important, and that employee has to go on the exchange and gets a credit or subsidy. Now, these credits and subsidies are substantial. I did a study for one of my clients, and there was an employee that was making between $22,000 to $24,000, went on the exchange, was eligible for credit and subsidy, purchased a $12,000 family coverage. Because of their income was relatively low, they only paid 2% of their household income, which was between $22,000 to $24,000. And because of that, their total premium for the year was only $461 for the year. Now, again, the employee is only eligible for credit and subsidy. It's either, as a large employer, you don't offer any coverage, or your coverage is either not affordable or not minimum essential coverage. If you do offer coverage and it's affordable, then they can go on the exchange, but they don't get any premium credits from subsidies. That's extremely important to remember. Now, what this next slide, slide three, is indicating is the fact that general effective date for these rules are January 1st, 2014. The IRS in December came out with some transitional rules that said that if you're an employer and if you offered coverage to at least a third of your employees, you're covered at least a quarter of your employees as of December 27, 2012, instead of that January 1st, 2014 date applying to you, you can use your first renewal in 2014 to comply with these rules. That's an extremely important exception. So what I'm trying to say here, and what this slide is trying to say, in order for you to get an extension of when the employer mandate kicks in, as of December 27, 2012, you either had to, one, cover at least one quarter of all your employees, which means full-time and part-time, or offered coverage to at least one-third of your employees. And then as of the first open enrollment in 2014, what you must do is offer your offer those eligible full-time employees that minimum essential value, which is 60%. So if you do that, you're fine. You can get that extension. So if your renewal date in 2014 is not until November, you have until November to comply. But in the past, you haven't offered your employees coverage, and you haven't covered or extended coverage to them in the past, that many employees, then you have to comply as of January 1st, 2014. So these two safe harbors would be available if you offer your employees minimum essential coverage, 60%. But in order to determine how many people you cover, you can use any most recent enrollment date between October 31st, 2012 and December 27, 2012. Now the question is, and the first question is, well, how do you determine whether you're a large employer? And that's the number one question many employers are asking. They're asking, well, I have a number of businesses. Do I have to combine them to determine whether if I am a large employer? And what the IRS has said is that you look at your control group. Does your employer control 80% or more of other businesses? And basically what the rules say is that if the same five or fewer individuals own at least 80% of each entity, then those entities are considered to be a control group, and they'd be considered to be one employer. That's extremely important to understand. So what this slide is trying to say, the employees of all employers within the control group would be taken into account in determining whether you are a large employer and whether you are subject to the mandate. So we don't care about separate EIN numbers. What we're concerned about is, does your employer or people who own your employer own other businesses? And if they do, for this purpose, all the ones that are commonly owned by your employer would be considered to be one employer, and therefore you may be subject to the employer mandate. Now, for this purpose, a large employer is an employer that employs, on average, at least 50 or more full-time employees, at least 50 full-time employees. What is a full-time employee for this purpose is anyone who works, on average, 30 hours. But what they've done in this situation is say also, to determine whether you're a large employer, you add in the hours of the part-timers. So as the second bullet on slide 6 indicates, in determining the number of full-time employees, an employer must add the total number of hours worked in a month by the part-timers and divide that by 120. Now, in this determination, we determine whether you're a large employer by looking how many people you employed during 2013. So we take the numbers for each month, total them up, and divide it by 12. That will give you an average for the year. If that figure is 50 or more, then therefore you're considered to be a large employer, and this employer mandate will apply to you. Now, please remember, this is the only time part-timers are considered, and their hours are only considered to determine whether you, as an employer, are a large employer. All right? That's extremely important to understand. But again, for this purpose, a full-timer is anyone who's worked, on average, at least 30 hours. So an employer must take into consideration part-time hours in account in determining whether that employer is an applicable large employer. And the number of full-time equivalents the employer employed during the preceding year are taken into account. So again, we consider all, and this is important, this third bullet on slide 7 is extremely important. We consider all employers, all employees, in considering whether that employer is a large employer. Now, again, in determining what we call full-time equivalencies and adding it to that number, we do a two-step process. We calculate the aggregate hours of service in a month for employees who are not full-time, and we divide that total number by 120. And for any month, that result will give us the number of what we call full-time equivalent employees. So again, the status of a large employer is based on the number of full-time employees in any business days, and the employer has proposed a multi-step process in calculating the number of full-time employees. This is what this process is. You calculate the number of full-timers for each month. You then add to that figure the number of full-time equivalencies, add the two numbers together, add up the 12-month numbers from step 3 and divide by 12, and if that resulting number is 50 or more, then you are considered to be a large employer and you have to be contend with the employer mandate. So let's look at an example of how this works. Okay? A firm with 35 full-time employees also has 20 part-timers who work 24 hours per week. So each employee works 24 hours per week and works a total of 96 hours per month. These part-timers would be counted as equivalent of 16 full-time employees. You take 20 employees, you multiply their by 96, we come up with 1,920 hours. We divide that by 120, and those 20 part-timers would add up to and be 16 full-timers. So you add that figure to 35, and for that month, that employer would have 51 full-time employees. And because that number is greater than 50, then that employer would be subject to the employer mandate. Now, again, you repeat that calculation that you see there on slide 11 for each month, total the number of hours, and then divide that by 12. And if the average is 50 or more, then that employer would be subject to the employer mandate. Now, what the IRS has indicated is that they realize they're getting this guidance out late, and what slide 12 is trying to say, for this determination, instead of using all of 2013. What this slide is trying to say is, Mr. Employer, for 2013, for use in 2014, you can use any six-month period to determine if you're a large employer during 2013. So again, instead of using a 12-month period for that determination, you can use a six-month period. Now, there's a special rule that came out, and again, the government loves special rules. And let me explain what this rule says. Let's say you had an employer that was a Dairy Queen. And generally, during the year, that Dairy Queen, or Dairy Queens, suppose you have more than one, employs a total of 30 employees. But during the summer months, 4 months or less, that operator of a Dairy Queen employs hundreds of people, hundreds of individuals. And because of those numbers during those 4 months, his average for the year would be more than 50, because he employs hundreds. So what they're saying here is, Mr. Employer, because of your seasonal employees who work 4 months or less, it makes you a large employer. What this is trying to say is, you can ignore any seasonal employees for this calculation only. Okay? So here, we would ignore those seasonal employees that work 4 months or less. And therefore, by doing that, that employer only has 30 employees, and therefore would be under the 50. That's what that slide is trying to say. Now, once we get done with determining whether an employer is a large employer, the second attribute is the fact that you are subject to a mandate. And that mandate says, one, you have to offer your employees, your full-time employees, affordable minimum essential coverage. And if you don't offer coverage to your employees, to your full-time employees, there's one penalty. And then the second question is, well, if you do offer coverage, then you're going to be penalized if either your coverage is not affordable or the coverage does not provide minimum value. So you could be penalized one of two ways. And I'll be explaining each of these, but your obligation, starting in 2014, is to offer your full-timers, employees 30 or more, coverage. And depending on what you do, you could be penalized. Now, in determining the penalty, for this purpose, the employer says a full-timer is anyone who works on average at least 30 hours per week or 130 hours per month. For this purpose, they up the figure. So in starting in 2014, you have no obligation to provide any coverage at all to your part-time people. Now, this is going to be an easy determination if you employ individuals that work a steady shift. They always work at least 30 hours a week. What the government says for those people, that the longest they can wait to get coverage is 90 days. So starting in 2014, there's going to be a 90-day waiting period. So anybody that works a steady shift has to be offered coverage and offered coverage on the 91st day. The situation is different for any employee who is considered to be a part-time or seasonal. In that situation, there are a couple of safe harbors you can apply to those individuals to determine whether they're full-time. And this is important, because as an employer, if you employ a lot of part-timers, and their hours may vary depending on the time of the year or the job they have, the government is saying is that 90-day requirement doesn't apply to them. And what you could do is have them wait to make a determination of whether they are elevated to full-time. and they have to jump through a couple of hoops for you to offer them coverage. All right, that's what they're saying. Now, what the IRS has done is created two safe harbors to help employers make that determination. Now, first of all, the first question is, who is an employee? Is anyone that you have what's called a common law standard, which means if you control their hours or where they worked, that's considered an employee. And counting hours, we count all hours that a person gets paid for, which includes vacation, sick time, that type of thing. Now, for hourly employees, you count their hours. For anyone who you don't usually count hours, the government says that you have three choices to make. You can actually start counting hours, or you can use what's called a worked equivalency. If somebody works a day for you, they're deemed to work 8 hours. If they work a week for you, they're deemed to work 40 hours. But the IRS warns the fact that it has to be based on reality, because if you know that your employees always work 9 or 10 hours, you can't use 8. And if you know that an employee always works, you know, more than 40, you can't use the 40 hours. It has to be based on reality. Now, as I indicated before, what you have to do is you have to look at all the hours that you pay them for. So paid leave is also included in determining how many hours they've worked. That includes time for vacation, holidays, leaves for illness, disability, or other capacity, layoffs, and jury duty or military duty is also included in this. All right? Now, in determining whether any of your part-timers or seasonal employees are full-time where you have to offer them coverage, the IRS has created two safe harbors, one for ongoing employees and one for new employees. Now, I want to warn you, these safe harbors are very complex and both rely on defined time periods. And this is extremely important because in 2014, if you don't offer coverage to an individual, you'll have to prove in the future to the DOL or IRS why you didn't offer these people coverage. And a way of getting insurance is by using these safe harbors. So these defined periods are, first of all, there is a measurement period. This is where you measure how many hours they work, and the period can be any period from 3 to 12 months where they average 30 hours. Now, as an employer, if you decide to use a 12-month measurement period, that means that in order for an employee to be full-time, they have to work on average 30 hours per week, 130 hours per month, or 1,560 hours for a 12-month period. That's a pretty high bar that a part-timer or seasonal would have to meet. Secondly, if an individual is determined to be full-time, then after the measurement period, there's something called a stability period, where you do offer them coverage. And that you continue to offer them coverage even if their hours dip below 30 hours. But employees who fail to meet the minimum threshold during the measurement period then will not be offered coverage during the measurement period, during the stability period, excuse me, and you will not be penalized. Remember in 2014, your obligation to provide coverage is only for those individuals that are considered to be full-time. You have no obligation to provide anybody who is part-time or seasonal any coverage unless they are deemed to be full-time. Now, there are a couple of rules here. The stability period can't be shorter in duration and months than the associated prior measurement period. If an employee meets the minimum hour threshold during the measurement period, then the stability period must last at least 6 months. And if the employee does not meet the minimum threshold, the stability period can't be longer than the measurement period. Now, in between the measurement and stability period is something called the administrative period. And the best way to remember this is where you enroll individuals. This is the enrollment period. It can be any period up to 90 days. Now, if you're an employer and you have different types of employees, Generally, these measurement periods must be uniform for all employees, but there are exceptions. You can have different measurement periods for collective bargaining versus non-collective bargaining, salaried versus hourly, and employees located in different states. Now, first of all, there's a measurement period for ongoing employees. These are people that have worked for you for a while. And these are called standard measurement and stability periods. And again, you can have any period from 3 to 12 months. You, as an employer, pick the period. And then you can have an optional administrative period where you sign them up for any coverage. All right? Let's look and see how this works. You as an employer do a calendar year, and you have a calendar year plan. That means you have to comply with health care reform as of 1/1/2014. You decide in this situation to use a 12-month measurement period. So as this illustration works, you had to start measuring people in 2012. So the standard measurement period is from 10/15/2012 to 10/14/2013. If you determine someone is full-time, then you sign them up during the administrative period, which is from 10/15/2013 to 12/31/2013. And then you offer them coverage as of 1/1/2014. So here the stability period is from 1/1/2014 to 12/31/2014. Now, every year you have to do this. So if an employee wants to have coverage after 12/31/2014, the employer then has to look back at a standard measurement period to see if that person continues to work full-time. If that individual continues to work full-time, then you continue to offer them coverage. If they are not working full-time, their hours dip below 30 hours, then at the end of 12/31/2014, you have to offer that employee COBRA. So as you can see from this, this is a year-by-year determination. And as an employer, you have to get close up and personal with your payroll company to measure hours. Now, to add insult to injury, there's also a second safe harbor period for new employees. So again, if you hire someone new during the year and you designate them as a part-time or seasonal employee, then you have to go through this measuring, and the measurement period starts when they start employment. You can measure it from the day they start employment or from the beginning of the month after they start employment. And this is called the initial measurement and stability periods. Now, for any employee that you hire that you know they're going to work 30 hours a week, all these calculations do not apply to them. The longest period of time they can wait is only 90 days. So this is important. So as an employer, what you have to do is make a determination when you hire somebody whether they are considered to be full-time, part-time, or seasonal employees. And these calculations only apply to those individuals that you consider to be part-time or seasonal. So here, for anybody you hire that's going to be part-time or seasonal, there's an initial measurement and stability periods. And again, you start those periods either the day that you hire them or the beginning of the month after you hire them. And there's several rules involved. The initial measurement and administrative periods combined cannot exceed 13 months plus a fraction of a month. And new hires' initial stability periods can't be shorter than the standard stability periods you use for ongoing employees. Once an employee has completed the initial measurement period and stability periods, then what happens is they're treated like an ongoing employee, and you use your standard measurement periods. So starting with the standard measurement period, you treat them just like everybody else, but again, at first, employees, and this is going to be a challenge, have their own initial measurement and stability periods. If an employee fails to meet the full-time status during the initial period, the initial stability period can't be more than 1 month longer than the employee's initial measurement period. And if the employee meets the full-time status during the overlapping or immediately ensuing standard measurement period, they must be treated as full-time. Now, again, the 90-day period only applies to those people that you hire that are deemed to be full-time. Now, this looks like a number of gobbledygook. It's extremely complicated. So how does it work? In order to illustrate how it works, I've come up with these charts. We have an example of Jim. He's a variable hour employee. He's part-time. And the employer has a calendar year plan. The employer decides to use a 11-month initial measurement period, followed by a single administrative period. Jim starts at 5/10/2014. The employer decides to use a 11-month initial period. So Jim's initial measurement period runs from 5/10/2014 to 4/9/2015. Then the employer has an administrative period to sign Jim up if he's full-time. And Jim's initial stability period runs from 7/15/2015 to 6/30/2016. All right? And again, the employer continues to offer Jim coverage even if he is working part-time. His hours dip below 30 hours. Now, to get coverage after 6/30/2016, what has to happen is Jim's employer has to determine whether Jim is full-time. And in order to do that, Jim is thrown into the employer standard measurement period, which is the second line. And that employer's measurement period runs from 10/15/2014 to 10/14/2015. And then Jim is offered coverage after his initial stability period from 7/1/2016 to 12/31/2016. For coverage after that, we go through the employer second standard cycle. All right? As you can see from this, this is extremely complicated, and the most important thing I would say in that situation, if you have part-time people, you have to start counting hours as soon as possible. Now, this is another alternative. In this situation, there's a variable hour employee. Again, there's a calendar year plan, but the employer decides to use a 12-month initial measurement period and decides in this situation to start measuring as of the beginning of the month after Sam starts. So there's a little itty-bitty administrative period at the beginning, a shorter one at the end. But again, Sam's coverage, if he's full-time, starts at 7/1/2015 and runs from 6/30/2016. Once Sam completes that initial stability period, the employer looks back to see if Sam was full-time during the employer's standard cycle. And if Sam is full-time during the standard cycle, then the employer offers him coverage from 7/1/2016 to 12/31/2016, and then for the next year, the employer looks back again. All right? Now, there's special rules for our various employers. There's one for educational employers that indicates that because they only, many of them work only 9 months, and we have to consider any hours worked during the time that they're in absence. So what the government says is that for employees returning from breaks, educational employers could use one of two averaging methods to treat as being continually employed. An employment break is a period of at least 4 consecutive weeks. And what the government says is that, well, one way of doing it, if somebody works 26 hours when they're working on their break, continue to assume they're working 26 weeks. The second is not assuming anything, but we count hours up to 501. So again, these are for employees working for an educational employer that have breaks. You have to consider some hours during those breaks. also the special rules for unpaid absences. Now, this is important because here, especially for seasonal employees, how do you treat an employee that works 7, 8, 9 months and come back the next year? Do you treat them as a new employee or a ongoing employee? What the IRS has said, if the period of absence for no hours is at least 26 weeks, the employer must treat the employee as having been terminated and rehired, so the second year they'd be treated as a new employee. But suppose the absence is less than 26 weeks. What slide 39 says, okay, what we do is that you only don't consider the hours before if the absence exceeds the amount they worked. So let's say you had a seasonal employee that works 8 months for you, leaves for 4 months, and comes back. According to this slide 39, the employer would have to treat that employee as an ongoing employee. And if that seasonal employee does work full time, when he or she comes back to employment, the employer would have to offer them coverage. So that's extremely important. Now for unpaid leave, the IRS has created a special rule. You can exclude any hours, exclude the period of special unpaid leave, that the average hours of service during the week, and use what they've worked, or you can credit an employee's special unpaid leave with hours of service at a rate equal to the employee's average weekly rate to see if that person is truly full-time. And this applies to unpaid leave under family and medical leave, jury duty, military leave. So the employer has to credit something during that unpaid leave. Now, the $64,000 question is when you have to start counting. If your calendar year plan or if the special transition rule doesn't apply to you, you have to be up and running and being able to determine whether any of your employees are full-time as of 1/1/2014. So that means you have to start counting hours in 2012. So this is something that many employers are grappling with as we speak. Now, in talking to many employers, I've come to the decision for many employers that a very long measurement period is probably preferable because it blocks out many part-timers from actually getting any coverage at all. So I would recommend in many situations using 11th or 12-month measurement period, and especially if you use a 12-month period, that means that that part-timer or seasonal would have to work 1,560 hours in total in order to get any coverage at all. But there are a few exceptions. For employers with large numbers of short-term employees, or shorter measurement and stability periods may be optimal, because then if they are full-time, you just offer them coverage for a very short period of time. But again, as this slide 42 illustrates, a 12-month stability period generally would be considered before alternative approaches in determining eligibility. Now, with the IRS, what this slide is trying to say, for 2013, because you have to start measuring then, they realize that many employers haven't started measuring hours. And what you can do is you can use a 6-month measurement period in 2013, and then in 2014, use a longer period for 2014. So they've created a special exception for 2013, saying if you use a 6-month period in 2013, we'll let you use a longer period for 2014. So what you should do. If you're a large employer that has a lot of part-timers, decide whether and how to adjust any waiting periods, gather data to determine whether and how safe harbors will apply, consider the safe harbor approaches, and especially since the DOL and IRS will be auditing many employers. And if you're using the safe harbors, determine the optimal measurement, administrative, and stability periods But whatever you do, amend your plan documents, communicate it to your employees to see so they know exactly what you're doing. Now, as I indicated before, starting in 2014, if you are a large employer, there's going to be an obligation that you have to offer coverage to those full-time employees. That's why that determination is extremely important. But what they've indicated, and this slide is very important, is that the application of the penalties will be applicable to each member of a control group. What does that mean? Suppose you're a large employer, and you have three members of the control group, and each member has 30 employees. So determining whether you're a large employer, they would be considered a large employer because it's 30, 30, and 30. So they would have 90 employees. So they are a large employer. But suppose two of the divisions, the employers in this control group, decide to have coverage, and the third one doesn't. Are you going to be penalized totally if that one division doesn't offer coverage? And what the IRS indicated in guidance in December is that we only look at that division that doesn't offer coverage and determine that penalty just on that one division that doesn't offer coverage. Now, if you don't offer coverage, slide 46 indicates that the penalty is $2,000 for each full-time employee. We don't consider part-timers beyond the first 30 employees. So if we have an employer that has 100 employees and they decide not to offer coverage, we take that 100 minus 30, which should leave 70, and then multiply that by 2,000, so their penalty would be $140,000. All right? Now, going back to my example with the three companies, what they indicated is that for this purpose, we only look at the company that doesn't offer coverage. But what they've indicated also is that minus 30 reduction is also prorated. So in my example with that company, with that one division that doesn't offer coverage, that 30 reduction is reduced down to a two-thirds or 10. So that division that doesn't offer coverage, we take 30 employees in that division minus 10, which is equals 20, and we apply the $2,000 penalty to just that one division. So their penalty would be only $40,000. So I have another example. An employer does not offer a medical coverage to its employees. It has 60 full-time employees, 12 part-timers, and two employees that purchase coverage through the exchange. The employer will owe a penalty of $5,000, which is 60 full-time employees minus 30, which it leaves 30, and therefore the penalty would be $60,000. Now remember, in this situation, the part-timers for this purpose are not considered. They're ignored. That's why that full-time determination is extremely important. So as this slide indicates it, as I just indicated, if you're a company and you let each division have their own plan, what you have to make sure in that situation is that each division, if they're offering coverage, must cover at least 95% of their employees. Because if you don't cover 95% of your employees, it's treated as if you're not offering any coverage at all. But again, it's applied separately to each division inside that control group. So coverage must be offered to full-time employees and their dependents. Now, what's interesting about this situation, a dependent is the children. As an employer in 2014, you're not required to offer any coverage to the spouse. So again, you have an obligation to offer coverage to the employee and their dependents, but no obligation to include the spouse in that coverage. Now, the second penalty that you're going to be penalized, that if you offer coverage and your obligation as an employer is to, for anyone who is eligible to offer them minimum essential coverage that is affordable. Affordable means that it cannot exceed 9.5% of their household income. As long as you do that, then as an employer, you're not going to be penalized. Now, if you miss one of the two obligations, the penalty is $3,000, but only for those employees that go on the exchange. So going back to my example of an employer with 100 employees, they decide to offer coverage, but it's deemed to be not affordable. And three employees go on the exchange. They're only going to be penalized 3,000 times three, or $9,000. What the second bullet on 51 indicates is the fact that for some reason all 100 employees go on the exchange, you're never penalized more than if you didn't offer coverage at all. The $2,000 minus the first 30. So here we have an employer has 55 full-time employees, 8 part-timers, and 3 seasonal employees. It offers coverage that is minimum value, but which is not affordable for 10 of their full-time employees, 9 of whom buy coverage through the exchange. All the part-timers, all 8 buy coverage through the exchange, and 2 of the seasonal employees, one whom buys through the exchange. So 7 of the 9 full-time employees, 6 of the part-timers, and the full-time seasonal employee who buy through the exchange qualify for premium credits. The employer owes a penalty for each full-timer who enrolls in coverage, which is the 7 regular full-time employees plus the 1 seasonal full-time employees. So they're penalized for that. So again, this illustrates the fact you only penalize for those employees who didn't get affordable coverage and who went on the exchange to purchase insurance and received a credit or subsidy. So again, we're only looking for those employees that go on the exchange and get credits and subsidies. Now again, you have to offer coverage to the employee and their spouse, and their children, excuse me. But, and this is what's interesting, the affordability test only applies to single coverage. So in order to meet this requirement, employees eligible for minimum essential coverage under an employer-sponsored plan may still qualify premium credits if the plan fails either of the two tests. It's going to be minimum value, and there's affordability test. And the premium exceeds 9.5% of the employee's household income. Now, what's important to understand, and please circle that affordability test only applies to single coverage. As an employer, you have no obligation to contribute towards the dependent coverage. None. And currently, in talking to many brokers, most employer coverages are way beyond the 60% figure. They're in the range of 70 to 80%. So in 2014, in order not to be penalized, what you may want to do is offer your employees a cheaper plan. Your obligation in 2014 is only contribute towards the employer-employee coverage. All right? You have no obligation to contribute towards the employee coverage. I'm sorry, to the dependent coverage. Now, an employer is treated as offering coverage to substantially all employees, again, if you offer coverage to at least 95% of all full-time employees. Now, this affordability test indicates that in order to meet that, it's 9.5% of household income. And the government realizes in no time will the employer ever know household income. So what they created three safe harbors that you can use as an employer to test whether your coverage is affordable. One, you can use box one of the employee's W-2, base it off of that. Two, you can base it off of the rate of pay. So whenever anyone works for you and they earn 10 or 12 bucks an hour, you multiply that rate of pay times 130 hours and base it off of that. Or third, you could base it on the federally poverty line safe harbor, and that's currently about $15,000 if base it off of that. Now, you may want to ask yourself, that means this determination could be individual by individual employee, and the answer is correct. So this is going to be your large challenge as an employer to make sure the coverage that you offer them meets that affordability standard. Now, what you may want to do when some employers are doing is base it on the employee that makes the least amount based off of that. But again, as your income goes up, the obligation of the employee to contribute more goes up. And that's fine. You can do that. But it's an individual by individual determination, employee. Now, minimum value, and again, most employer coverages right now exceed that 6% figure. And what many employers are doing in 2014 is they're considering offering a cheaper plan to their employees and basing their contribution off of that cheaper plan, all right? And it's fine, you can do that. You can say our contributions are based on that 60% plan, but if you want something better, we offer a second or third plan and doing it that way. Now, many employers say, well, if I have union employees, am I off the hook? Because I contribute to a union plan. And just because you contribute to a union plan doesn't mean you're off the hook. Here, there are three conditions not to be penalized. The collective bargaining agreement requires the employer to contribute towards a full-time employee's coverage. The full-time employees and dependents are offered coverage, and the coverage is deemed affordable and has minimum 60% value. So union employees are considered to determine with your large employer, and as an employer, you have to make sure their coverages are affordable and minimal essential coverage. So each participating employer is responsible for identifying its full-time employees based on hours, and you could pay a penalty if the multi-employer plan doesn't meet this requirement. Now, in determining whether that coverage is affordable, the proposed regulations by the IRS said, give participating employers a fourth safe harbor. Coverage would be affordable if the employee's required contributions for individual coverage does not exceed 9.5% of wages, either actual wages or the hourly rate under an applicable collective bargaining. So you can base it off of that. Now, what's going to happen in 2014 is that you're going to get a notice from the IRS notifying you that one of your employees went on the exchange and got a credit and subsidy. So you must receive as an employer notification of the appeals process so that we'll do that before you get a notice that you're going to be penalized starting in 2014. So when the exchange determines an applicant is eligible to receive advance payments of premium credit or subsidy, they must base on finding that his employer does not provide minimum essential coverage or provides coverage that's not affordable. And these are going to be questions on the application. So if an employee claims they're not covered by a plan or their their plan is not credible, they will notify you, ask you whether your plan is credible or not, and that's when you would say, yes, I am, or no, I'm not. So this notice from the exchange, the IRS will include the employee's identity, that the employee has been determined to be eligible for any premium credits, and that the employer will be liable for shared responsibility payment, the penalty. And then the IRS will contact employers to inform them of their potential liability and provide them with an opportunity to respond before any liability is assessed. That's where you prove the fact that the employee was incorrect. And the contact for any given year will not occur until after the employee's individual tax returns are due. All right. If it's determined that you as an employer is liable for any penalties after the employer has responded, the IRS will then send a notice and demand payment. And then the IRS will then instruct you how to make the payment. Now, starting in 2014, if you are a large employer, all right, you're going to have reporting responsibilities to the IRS. In addition to that, you have to report that information to your employees. This is starting in 2014. These returns are going to be filed in 2015. And the IRS will use that information to then verify whether the employees are telling the truth. Now, this is the information that you have to provide to the IRS. The employer's name, date, EIN number, certification whether you're offering coverage, number of full-time employees, the name, address, and tax ID number of each full-time employee, and any other information provided to the that they are required by the IRS. This information may include months during which the calendar year in which coverage was available, the monthly premium, the employer's share of total costs, the waiting period, and which coverage you paid the largest portion. Now, in addition to that, you have to report this information to your employees, and you must give it to them the following January 31st. So as you can see from this, starting in 2014, if you're a large employer, you're going to have tons of responsibilities starting in 2014. And if one of your employees goes on the exchange and gets a credit of subsidy, then you have to respond to the IRS and make sure they understood, yes, I did offer that employee coverage. All right. So as you can see, this is extremely, extremely complicated. Mark, do you have any questions?
It seems impossible to me. How do the employer has to determine an awful lot of things up front. They have to verify a number of issues ongoing, and then they have a ton of reporting requirements.
Well, this is in order to see what's going to happen is in 2013, when the first open enrollment is October 2013, I've looked at the application to the exchanges, and the application is 21 pages. And the reason why it's 21 pages, there's a number of questions in regard to the employer coverage. Now, suppose your employee tells them, I don't have any coverage. I wasn't offered coverage. I'm not being offered coverage. Give me the creditor to subsidy. They get it. After that, the IRS will then send you a letter, a notice saying, one of your employees went on the exchange and got a credit and subsidy. What about this? Then as an employer, you have to respond to them, because if you don't, you're going to be penalized. That's what's going to happen. Now, this is my contact information. As part of the seminar, I sent out last night a copy of the slides and also an explanation of the mandate. I know the first time you hear this, it's complete gobbledygook, and it's extremely complicated. I also have a newsletter that comes out 6 to 8 times a month on top topics as this. So if you want to sign up, just go to my website and sign up for it. It's completely free. And I follow these trends almost on a daily basis. Now, Mark, it doesn't look like we have any questions. So if you have any further comments, Mark?
Everybody knows what to do.
And this is a moving target. Now, over probably the next 2 to 3 months, you're probably going to see news reports about the exchanges. In Illinois, for example, we're going to do a partnership with the feds, and probably later in 2013, either late summer, early fall, you're going to be required to give your employees a notice of the exchange. And if you don't give that notice, you're going to be penalized $100 per employee who didn't get it. So please look out for that notice, because you have to give that notice, and that notice will explain to the employees what they have to do to go on the exchange. So I would imagine that notice would be coming out either July, August, or early September. All right?
But if they carry a qualified health plan, do they want to be sending the employees to the exchange?
No, I'm not saying sending the exchange. You have to give them notice of the exchange.
Okay.
You can't bar from any employee going to exchange. They can do so. Now, if you offer them affordable coverage, that's minimum, they won't get any credits and subsidies on the exchange. But they can still go and purchase coverage. And if they do, they're not eligible for any credits and subsidies if you offer them affordable coverage. All right? So they have to pay on the exchange, they have to pay full freight. Now, on the exchanges, for until 2017, only individuals and small employers can go on the exchange. And a small employer is any employer 50 or less can go on the exchange, or less than 50, excuse me. So not every employer can go on the exchange. And there's going to be services for individual purchase and group purchase. But I don't think there's not going to be that much assistance on the exchange at first, because they're still building this as we speak. So a lot of things are going to be happening over the next 6 months. If you didn't get a copy of the slides or the explanation, send me an email. I'll be more than glad to send, or send Mark an email, because he has a copy of everything. Mark, thank you very much for the invite. I appreciate it. And stay tuned for other developments.
Thank you.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye.